Thanks. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed your dinner. Thank you very much for coming to the FCC here tonight for our screening of Muzzling the Messenger, followed by what I hope will be a lively discussion with the filmmakers and all of the distinguished members of the audience here tonight on the subject of press freedom in Hong Kong and what we can do to protect and enhance it. My name, quickly, is Douglas Wong, and when I came to Hong Kong from Singapore 10 years ago, it was a thrill and a privilege to join this club, which lives and breathes the achievements of generations of media heroes, and where you can also meet and mingle with great public servants, corporate titans, and of course, artists and filmmakers. I met our two presenters tonight, Lin Lee and James Leong, right here in this room earlier this year, when they won a Human Rights Press Award for their documentary on Wuhan, that little village across the border where they've been experimenting with democracy. That was their second award from the FCC, adding to a clutch that they've won in a decade of filmmaking that has taken them and their viewers from East Timor to Cambodia, North Korea, and the Hong Kong of the players of Homeless FC and other movies of theirs that many of us might not have seen yet. I look forward to a great discussion after the screening, and without further ado, can I ask James to quickly introduce their film tonight?
Thank you very much for coming. Lin and I recently moved here from Singapore about a year ago, and I think both of us always thought that press freedom in Hong Kong was very good. I grew up here, and for much of my childhood, Lin worked here as a journalist between 2000 and 2002, yeah. But when we arrived, we kind of walked into what's been described by the Hong Kong Journalists Association as the worst year for press freedom in Hong Kong. So we went on the February 23rd demonstration in support of press freedom. And 3 days later, Kevin Lau, the former editor of Ming Bao, was attacked, hacked in the street. And we just felt that we really had to do something to make a documentary about this. And what you're going to see now is the result of that. That's it. Thank you.
Once home to Asia's freest press. But no longer
being made to muzzle the media. I'm Steve Chow. On this edition of 101 East, we ask, what does the future hold for Hong Kong's outspoken press?
It was once home to Asia's freest press. But no longer. And for this crowd, the situation is unacceptable. Hong Kong ranked 18th on the Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index in 2002. 12 years on, it's fallen to 61st on that list. Many blame interference by the Chinese government.
More and more people are willing to cooperate with Beijing to create a press situation here that is less critical of the communist regime up there.
Developments at the start of this year triggered more anxiety. Kevin Lau, the chief editor of local daily newspaper Ming Pao, was abruptly dismissed. Weeks later, outspoken radio show host and government critic Li Wai-ling also lost her job. Xi pointed the finger at Hong Kong's chief executive.
今次的事件是梁振英政府对新闻自由、对言论自由的打压。
The uproar over the erosion of press freedom comes at a politically sensitive time for Hong Kong. China has promised to grant the special administrative region universal suffrage by 2017. Many here believe that Beijing isn't likely to keep its word and that attempts to undermine the media are a sign of things to come.
I always believe and say that when there's no more press freedom, no other freedom is safe.
It's a sentiment that resonates with many gathered here today. Hong Kong's constitution guarantees its residents freedoms not seen elsewhere in China. There is now a genuine fear that things could change.
你为了你的小朋友、你的孩子的将来，请你向灭声说不。
3 days later, some shocking news. Kevin Lau, whose dismissal from Ming Pao sparked the protest, is in hospital, the victim of a vicious cleaver attack.
Hong Kong is a free society. These violent actions are not tolerated. They should be under the whole society's control.
The attack sparked an even bigger protest. Hong Kong is a relatively safe city, but in the past year alone, there have been more than half a dozen reported cases of violence against journalists and media outlets.
劉俊濤被黑社會斬傷，明顯係同新聞自由有關。喺呢個時間，我哋唔出嚟發聲，就係死於沉默之中。
More than 10,000 protesters march on police headquarters in a show of support for Lau.
So the journalists are saying that they are facing unprecedented pressure and attacks. So that's why so many people have come out today to support them.
11 suspects have been arrested and a trial will be underway soon.
Investigators have worked tirelessly around the clock.
But authorities have been reluctant to link the incident with Lau's work as a journalist.
But until you find out what were the reasons for such an indecent act, you cannot make the claim as a journalist or as a news. You cannot just reporting on what you feel. Give me the facts.
Kevin Lau remains in hospital. He has to learn to walk again. Each step is a tiny victory. Lau's nerves were badly damaged during the attack, and doctors say he may need more surgery.
The road to recovery is still long and uncertain. Human nerves grow very slowly, just 1 millimeter each day. So it may take a year or even 2 years for my feet and toes to resume basic functionality. I cannot comment on the case until it's over. But I would like to urge the Hong Kong police force to use every possible means to investigate and find out the mastermind behind the scene, the person who ordered the attack on an innocent journalist in broad daylight.
The attack on Lau has unnerved many in the media. The first time we meet Edward Chin, he's with the police. The front door of his office building has been smashed, and he's making a report.
Now, at this point, I don't want to make any assumption, and I just reported the police just 2 hours ago and just came back from the police station.
Chin is a hedge fund manager, but he's also a columnist, pro-democracy activist, and radio show host.
Do you personally support the freedom of speech, no matter which country?
He often uses his shows as platforms to discuss issues close to his heart. But he says it's become increasingly difficult for people in the media to speak their minds.
In a weekly column that I write, I was told not to focus too much on politics or current affairs, just focus on your long-short trading strategies, and then it came to me as a surprise. That happened a few months ago, and I think that it's because of the mainland influence.
In April this year, Chin decided to take action. He and some 70 colleagues from the finance industry wrote an open letter to the Chinese government setting out 10 requests. Among them, that Beijing respect Hong Kong's right to free speech and a free press.
For us as a group in the financial and banking sectors, freedom of information, freedom of press is especially important for us. I think for investment, is at the end of the day, is gathering information and to make informative decisions. So if there's no freedom of speech, I think we will jeopardize Hong Kong as the international finance center.
The group is also part of Occupy Central, a movement that's vowed to hold civil disobedience protests if China backtracks on its promise to let Hong Kongers choose their own leader by 2017. Today, they're voting on proposals for a referendum on how Hong Kong's election candidates should be nominated.
It's a general increasing political tensions between Hong Kong and Beijing. And that somehow, I mean, at the same time, we see a tightening of the media control.
We are now discussing on ways to have this universal suffrage. And Beijing want to have an election where it can be certain of the result before the election was being held. But we want a truly democratic election that will truly reflect the views of the people.
Veteran Hong Kong journalist Ching Chong knows what it means to be on the wrong side of the Chinese government. In 2005, he was accused of spying on them for Taiwan, a charge he's consistently denied. Despite international protests, he spent nearly 3 years in prison in China. He's now retired, but plans to set up a website on press freedom in Hong Kong. Ching believes Beijing's attempts to influence public opinion started even before Hong Kong returned to Chinese rule in 1997.
In the last days of the British colonial rule, media operators, knowing that major changes are coming, try to adapt to these changes by adjusting their editorial policy towards China. Then we also saw, to prepare for this takeover of Hong Kong, China has already started co-opting media operators in Hong Kong to join their political game.
More than half of Hong Kong's media owners hold political appointments in China. These include Charles Ho of the Tsing Tao Group and Richard Lee, who owns 50% of the influential Economic Journal. Ming Pao, often cited as the city's most credible Chinese daily and Hong Kong's leading English newspaper, the South China Morning Post, are both controlled by Malaysian owners with significant business interests in China. The South China Morning Post editor-in-chief, Wang Shangwei, is a former member of China's top advisory body, the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference. Wang came under fire in June 2012 when noisy protesters marched on the South China Morning Post. They accused him of downplaying news of the mysterious death of Chinese dissident Li Wangyang. The protests were sparked when emails between Wang and a sub-editor at the paper, Alex Price, began circulating online. In the first of several messages to his chief editor, Price asked, "A lot of people are wondering why we nibbed the Li Wangyang story last night. It does seem rather odd. Any chance you can shed some light on the matter?" In one of his replies, Wang wrote, "I don't have to explain to you anything. I made the decision and I stand by it. If you don't like it, you know what to do." Both Wang and Price declined our requests for interviews, but we meet a former journalist from the paper, Tim Hamlet. He had left the Post by 2012, but after learning of the exchange between Price and Wang, Hamlet and 22 of his ex-colleagues sent an open letter to the paper's executive director, detailing their concerns over the matter.
Maybe Mr. Wang sort of just glanced at the first paragraph and didn't realize what it was, but it was not the first time. Not the first time that the Post had appeared to be influenced in its news values by a desire not to offend.
There is one major Hong Kong newspaper with an owner who has no known business ties with China. Apple Daily, part of tycoon Jimmy Lai's Next Media Group.
If people knew the things he's been offered in China that I know about, you know, the would you like to have this sports information company? Would you like to do financial news? Would you like to do lifestyle news? He gets offered this stuff all the time, but he knows you can't really do it.
It's one of Hong Kong's biggest newspapers and arguably one of its most vocal. Apple Daily and its sister publications are unabashedly pro-democracy and openly critical of authorities in Hong Kong and Beijing, a position they say has hurt advertising revenues.
Some of these large companies have bent over for the Chinese, HSBC, Standard Chartered, Bank of East Asia, Mercedes-Benz, large insurance companies, Chinese insurance companies, Sun Life, they're gone.
I think if within the right of the company or individual, in terms of where they want to or not want to put their advertising money, okay? And the media who, by and large, operate as private enterprises or personal enterprise, also have the right to choose where they want to stand on certain issue, who to criticize or who to praise, and they fully know the consequence, the economic consequence of their action in this marketplace.
南華早報咁咪畫咗個卡通出嚟嘅，即係喺法庭嗰度個牌。 It's just past two, and the Apple Daily team is holding its afternoon news meeting. Chung Kim Hung is the paper's chief editor.
Pro-democracy, freedom, free market, this is the core value of our newspaper. There's no journalist ever come to me to tell me that, oh, I'm too scared, I don't want to do this reporting. No. No.
There's good reason to be cautious. In June 2013, a stolen car was rammed into the front gate of Next Media founder Jimmy Lai's home. An axe and a machete were left outside. Less than 2 weeks later, knife-wielding masked men set fire to some 26,000 copies of Apple Daily at a distribution point. That same day, a cleaver was found outside the entrance of the company's building.
The pressure that we get on us, really, we do not believe that it is always Beijing-inspired. What we do believe, though, is that Beijing is receptive to it. In other words, this is people bringing gifts to Caesar.
早晨，早晨。
One floor down, Li Weiling is preparing for her new show. She was offered a job with Next Media shortly after being dismissed from commercial radio.
當離開咗商台嘅時候，又面對香港而家嗰個即係新嘅情況咧，我自己覺得好希望咧繼續咧可以咧喺新聞工作嘅崗位度咧繼續幫市民發聲啊。其實葉建源，你自己係點睇新聞自由咧？
對新聞自由嗰個重視嘅程度，我相信啊。
因為新聞自由對香港嚟講都係好重要噶嘛，咁尤其是喺踏入2014年咧，我哋見到咧，即係而家新聞界咧遇到即係種種嘅問題，大家睇到咧，我哋香港嘅新聞自由咧，好似突然間咧跌到落咧即係冰河時代，咁我覺得個危機感係好重咯，咁所以我覺得係大家應該要即係多關注呢個問題。
Across town, journalists at another newsroom are also hard at work.But Chinese daily Ta Kong Pao offers up a somewhat different perspective.
这个大公报啊，大家都知道是一个爱国的啊，也就是亲北京的政府。
Senior editor Yip Chung Man has been at the paper for nearly 50 years.
这是我们今天的报纸。香港的问题呢，基本上政治问题啊、社会啊、民生啊，我都要写。这里两篇东西呢，就是我写的。因为最近香港有的人就要鼓吹叫学生去占领中环，教育局就说不能去，去了以后啊，影响你们将来的前途啊，升学、就业、当公务员。当时是中华人民共和国中央人民政府成立啊，那当时是毛泽东发表一个公告。
Founded in 1902, it's a paper with a long and storied history. Under British rule, however, Ta Kung Pao found itself on the wrong side of the law. In 1952, it was charged with inciting a riot at a railway station and told to cease reporting for 6 months.
但是就因为我们这个亲北京的背景，就借着这个事说我们煽动。当时的英国人政府啊，就控告大公报，说是因为我们登了这个消息，鼓励那些人到火车站去，制造了这一次的暴动，所以就控告大公报煽动暴动。
Yip says things have changed since Britain handed Hong Kong back to China.
回归以后，我们也看到有些报纸啊。就是几乎啊，到什么七月一号特区成立的周年纪念，或者一月一号新年，或者甚至于那个北京六四那个事情的周年，他们都发动那个读者市民去游行，但是他们没有受到政府的任何的法律的那个追究，所以光是从这一个比较，我觉得回归以后的。新闻自由啊，那个程度啊，是大大的放宽了，也更加走向这个是公平的。
言论自由，
言论
自由，新闻自由，言论自由。
But the Chinese government has never hidden its desire to control the media. Across the border from Hong Kong, angry protesters in Guangzhou.Staged an unprecedented demonstration against state censorship in early 2013. This after allegations that an article in the outspoken Southern Weekly newspaper had been doctored by the government. Among those accused of censoring the paper, propaganda official Yang Jian. Yang is now in Hong Kong, working at China's government liaison office.Reports say he's in charge of publicity and propaganda. He was seen recently in public, speaking in the aftermath of the attack on Kevin Lau.
Hong Kong is a free society. We don't allow, don't tolerate any illegal behavior. We strongly support the government, with all its might, to uphold the law and order.
The exact reach and influence of the government liaison office is a subject of much speculation. It declined our request for an interview. But human rights activist and lawyer Martin Lee says the office is increasingly making its presence felt in Hong Kong.
Effectively, it's no longer Hong Kong people ruling Hong Kong or governing this place, but the Beijing apparatchiks, Communist Party cadres, housed in a building in the western part of Hong Kong called the Central Government Liaison Office. Now, these people are running Hong Kong. And freedoms are clearly being infringed, particularly freedom of the press, because no communist government likes a free press.
It's the 25th anniversary of the June 4th crackdown in China. Mark Yingting and her fellow journalists are promoting their book in Victoria Park. They've called it People Will Not Forget, a collection of reports by Hong Kong journalists who were in Beijing when tanks started rolling towards Tiananmen Square. They sell hundreds of books today. A quarter of a century after the crackdown, people are still interested in learning more about it.
The book could not sell in China, we all know that. But we have put the content of the book on the website. So we hope very much that the mainland people can cross over the Great Firewall and get access to the book and know what happened in 1989, to know the truth, to know the facts, so that they will not forget what happened.
Hong Kong is the only Chinese city where June 4th can be openly commemorated and discussed. This gathering is an annual event, and this year draws an estimated 180,000 people. For activists and journalists in China, it's also a difficult time. Many were detained in the run-up to the anniversary. The June 4th crackdown remains a sensitive topic in the mainland, something Beijing would rather people not remember.
It is very important for us to safeguard the press freedom in Hong Kong so that people will know what happened, and trying to tell what we saw in Beijing to the world when the government trying to cover up everything.
And so journalists like Mark are still speaking up. And though some might say that the space to do so is getting smaller, Hong Kong remains unique in a country that prefers to forget. Those who gather here are still able to light that candle, to speak their minds, and to remember. For now, at least.
That's actually the second time I've seen that documentary, and as someone who's tried to make a living with the written word, I have to say still that the visual storytelling is still so much more powerful, and I think must reach a much, much broader audience. I hope you enjoyed the movie, and I hope that we can now have, you know, your thoughts, your questions. We have Lynn and James willing to stay as long as any of you are to talk and discuss this. So I could start, but if anyone would like to begin the proceedings with a question, I will start by just giving a little spoiler here that James and Lynn are actually working on, in a way, a sequel to the movie. This movie, is that a spoiler? I'm sorry, you have to keep it confidential then. On Occupy Central, which I think is going to be ready for October. But I was reminded watching that about how a lot of these themes of freedom of the press are tied up these critical issues for Hong Kong of the democratic future for Hong Kong and how we're going to achieve that. But if I could ask anyone here who has a question or contribution or thought that they'd like to raise, the gentleman in the front, if you could just identify yourself and you know, this is less formal than a lunch talk. You know, this is a discussion. Let's have a good discussion. Thanks.
Thanks very much. My name's Stuart Heaver. I'm a freelance journalist based in Hong Kong. I'd just like to thank you very much, first of all, for an absolutely brilliant documentary. My immediate question was, you focused a lot on print media and the potential censorship of print media. So I wanted to ask you, to what extent is the internet Hong Kong's potential antidote to Beijing-inspired censorship?
Actually, one of the most influential internet kind of sites, blogs, recently closed down, the House News. I don't know if you've heard about that website. They were apparently about to do a tie-up with, was it the Wall Street Journal? With the Wall Street Journal. I think they seemed to be doing okay. And then it closed very suddenly, and the founder, Tony Choi, has not been contactable since. But someone who worked very closely with him has written a few pieces about it, and it was a surprise to everyone. Actually, maybe I can read on the website of the House News. There's the reason why he closed it down, and I can maybe have to read that. What he says is, I fear the current atmosphere of political struggle is extremely unsettling. A number of the Democratic camp members are being stalked, smeared, and having some old stories dug out. A wave of white terror envelops the society, and I feel it. And as a businessman who often travels up to the mainland, I have to admit, every time I cross the border, I would get jittery. Am I just being paranoid? That feeling is inexplicable to outsiders. But what unsettles me most is my family also feels this pressure, and they worry about me all the time. That breaks my heart. And I think he'd just been up to China for a trip, and when he came back, that's when the website was closed down. So, I don't know if online is going to...
When we were making this documentary, the people we spoke to, like Ching Chong, for instance, and even Mark Simon, they were quite optimistic about how the online media would neutralize the threat that was, the threat to mainstream media. And at that time, I think we were quite optimistic as well. And then more recently, the House News closure happened, and I think that, it's been a shock.
Nick Thompson, no affiliation. What can the average person in Hong Kong do to help? And the perception, from my point of view, of Occupy Hong Kong has been some chaps sitting on armchairs or sofas around the pier that goes out to the Star Ferry. And they don't seem to be Hong Kongers. And they just seem to be sitting around smoking, and it doesn't create a very good impression of Occupy Central. Are they anything to do with it?
I don't know what those guys are. They're protesting about refugee rights. They're not actually related to the Occupy Central movement.
Right. The trouble is that people seem to assume that they are.
Yeah.
It's a shame that Occupy Central is getting a bad name, isn't it? You know, it's not the pure thing that it was set up to be.
Well, I think at the moment there's a concerted campaign against Occupy Central. They're speaking the same language. This is the anti-Occupy Central signature campaign. And it feels a little odd because they're speaking the same language, but they're actually trying to kind of get people to accept what the Chinese government is going to offer. You know, let's pocket it first. Let's accept less, but they're using the language of democracy in order to promote something that you could say is anti-democratic, maybe. So I think a lot of the perception of Occupy Central, especially in the last like month or so, has come from this group. I think they call themselves the Alliance for Peace and Democracy.
I'd like to thank you for that question, because again, one of the reasons that we put on events like this at the FCC is so that we can demonstrate our support for important issues like freedom of the press, but also so we can discuss what more it is we can do. And you know, I'm going to entirely abuse my position in the chair now, because we do have Ms. Anson Chan here in the audience, and I'm going to ask her whether she has any thoughts about what we as ordinary residents of Hong Kong can do, because not just have we had this terrible incident with the House News, but we've also had, to my mind, just as an observer, this quite disturbing campaign against or kind of media kind of frenzy over the leaked Jimmy Lai contributions issue, which I have to see as, I have to interpret myself just as an ordinary reader, as an attack on Apple Daily and what it's trying to do as a journalistic institution. So if, again, I hope you forgive me, Ms. Chan, but just given your experience, what are your thoughts on what we as ordinary Hong Kong residents can do to help the cause of press freedom in Hong Kong?
I have several observations. The first, as regards press freedom, I think every one of us need to realize that press freedom isn't something remotely detached from our everyday life. If you're a businessman, if you're an ordinary citizen going about your work, anybody in any capacity, you really ought to sit up and take notice about what is going on right under your very nose. You've seen the documentary. You've seen what has happened with the proprietor of House News, who was really one of the main reasons he himself explained why he closed down House News was simply, even if he could take the intimidation himself, he could not take it on behalf of his family. You look at the way that Jimmy Lai's email have all been hacked. They're all out there in the public domain. Does the government do anything about questioning why this intrusion into people's privacy? Instead, what you have is a constant stream of innuendos, intimidation, including people like myself who are just trying to make Hong Kong a better place. This insinuation that somehow I've received money from Jimmy Lai and I'm using it to top up my everyday expenses, etc., etc., etc. It takes a very brave person, actually, in today's Hong Kong to stand up and be counted. But I ask you to ask yourself, is this the way that Hong Kong is going to go? Are we all simply going to just capitulate, fold our arms and do nothing? I find it particularly pathetic that the commercial and the business sector does not sit up and take notice. Surely it cannot be in their own commercial interest to see a fettered press. And yet what do you see? You see HSBC, Standard Chartered, and Bank of East Asia all giving in to a threat from the liaison office to lift their advertisements from Apple Daily. Well, I ask you to ask yourself one question. If this continues, one of these days, all of us will be reading the two left-wing newspapers, that is Dai Gong and Man Wei, and nothing else. I can only say to you, as I'm trying to do in my own small way, is to stand up and be counted and do not give in to this sort of pressure. Will we succeed? I don't know. But I do know one thing. If you sit back, you fold your arms, and you do nothing, you can be guaranteed 100% failure. If you attempt to do something, even if it is just to speak up and mouth your concern and express your concern, I cannot guarantee you success, but at least you stand a higher chance of succeeding in protecting the Hong Kong that we all love. We want to continue to live in Hong Kong. I'm not worried about my generation. I don't think things will deteriorate to such an extent that I'm forced to leave. But I do worry for my children, and I worry particularly for my grandchildren.
Any other contributions or questions from the floor? The lady at the front. Thank you.
This is just a question about your audience. Al Jazeera has emerged as this wonderful third force in global journalism. But I'm sorry, I don't watch it all the time. How do you have any idea the viewership of this particular episode? Has it already screened or not?
Actually, we don't. It has screened, and we've had emails and questions and things like that. But as to the actual numbers, I don't know. We don't know. Yeah, we know it's available to 220 million households, but we don't know how many people watch.
I do believe it's actually available free online. So so you could share it with your friends if you find it on the website. But I was going to, if I could just follow up on your question, I was going to ask, I'm very interested to know what sort of feedback you've got on this movie. And because as I said earlier, I think that you really, with the visual medium, you reach a much broader audience, I think, than you can with the written word. So I'd be interested whether you've had feedback that you did not expect on the movie and how that may affect your next show about Occupy Central, if at all.
I think one of the more interesting responses we got was someone saying, why are you saying that things are so bad now? Look at how things were pre-handover. The British didn't do much with democracy or freedom of speech in Hong Kong. And then it triggered this big debate between two people on that particular page. And actually, when we were interviewing Mr. Xu Xinpo, he said the same thing as well. He said, if you look at what life was like under the British, then you're being hypocritical, accusing the Chinese government of not giving Hong Kong enough freedoms because we were not that free under the British. And I think our response to him was, the yardstick shouldn't be what life was like under the British. The yardstick should be what life has been like since the handover, and it's clear that there's been a deterioration since the handover. And it doesn't matter, I think, if it was not so free under the British, because people don't look back like that. People look at what the situation is right now, and they judge from there. And if Hong Kong has gone from being the best in Asia to 61st, then it's clearly something to be concerned about.
Thanks for that movie, by the way, to begin with. That was fantastic. I do have a question of your selection of material in isolating Hong Kong from, the China general media climate, maybe, especially Guangdong, where you did mention briefly there are opposing voices fighting for the same things. Shouldn't that be bigger part of the debate of Hong Kong, what goes on the mainland, and maybe why? I can perhaps guess why you didn't focus more on making interviews on the mainland, but would you not have preferred to make that a bigger part of your documentary?
Well, I think one thing is the time constraint. We have 25 minutes, and we wanted to focus on the situation in Hong Kong. But it is important what's going on the mainland, and particularly in Guangdong, where just 2 years ago we were at the elections held in Wukan, which was the village which overthrew their village committee because of some like really really dodgy land sales, and there was a kind of great feeling that this was a kind of new beginning. It was like a sort of spring. And we were covering the elections there, and there, I think there must have been about 200 or 300 reporters from all around the world, including a contingent of maybe 100 from Hong Kong. And you know, you could really feel there was a lot of media freedom at that time. And then we followed this story for a couple of years, and we We filmed the recent election, 2014 election, the one after the 2012 one, and there were perhaps like a dozen foreign reporters there, and the restrictions were quite severe this time round. So it's almost that there was an opening up and then a kind of closing again. You know, to the extent that you would get followed around when you're walking around the village, you know, you see like local journalists there, and as soon as like foreign media people go in, they stop filming like what's going on in the elections, they point their cameras at you. So, you know, you don't really know whether like local journalists or part of the propaganda department. So I think the situation in China is, especially recently, has gotten a lot more restrictive, and you can really feel it. In Hong Kong, I mean, we've actually, in filming the Occupy Central documentary, we've actually had people taking our photographs, which I've never experienced here before. You know, you'll be like, you'll be filming something, you turn around, there's someone behind you actually trying to take a snapshot of you, which is more what you'd expect to experience in China. So I think even like every day, practically, from every day working, you kind of notice these small things happening. You know, slowly, it's getting kind of eroded more and more until, you know, one day you'll just find it's changed completely. So I don't know if that really answered the question. Thanks.
Hi, my name's David Coles. I'm in education, nothing to do with journalism. However, I'm wondering how sanguine people are about the future. One of the things which has really encouraged me in recent years and months in Hong Kong has been the rise of interest among young people about political situation, about current affairs, about their role and their rights and responsibilities. And I found it immensely encouraging as someone who's been in Hong Kong long enough to know when school children at the secondary level were a lot more timid and the notion of speaking out was quite alien to them. So I think that's very encouraging. I'm wondering, looking forward, and obviously the FCC is probably not the best place to speculate about the future of print journalism, but, you know, if you're on the MTR, or even if I'm in Guangzhou on the subway there, I don't see too many young people reading newspapers. And yet the ability for them to actually bypass the Great Firewall in China now, I think from talking to young people there, seems to be increasing. So I'm just wondering, unless you've got a North Korea, how possible will it be even for mainland China to totally suppress freedom of speech in the medium term?
It's quite interesting. I think in July this year, they came up with a whole new bunch of rules. Very confusing for people like us who are trying to do stories in China. You're not allowed to report news that hasn't been publicized by official channels before. So, in other words, unless it's put out by the government, this is my interpretation. You're not supposed to put it out yourself. Now, how does that work if you're a journalist and you find something out? And then more recently, there's been an attempt to control what goes out on social media. I think you're no longer allowed to share news on WeChat, for instance. So going back to like when we were in Wuhan 2 years ago and the young activists there being able to get online, to blog, to use VPN, to, you know, go around the great or go over the Great Firewall, to what it's like today, we're no longer able to get in touch with the activists that we were in contact with. Their phone lines are being monitored, their internet accounts are being monitored or have been shut down. The chat groups have been taken down, I think. There's been a significant clamping down in the last 2 years. There have been arrests, there have been people being intimidated. I think it's a really tough environment. Personally, we don't think it looks very good in China right now, and You're right. We think that in Hong Kong, we should be especially concerned.
I'm just wondering, with the increasing sophistication of technology and the ability to actually bypass the censorship, whether or not anyone shares any shred of hope for the future in the medium term.
If I could just quickly interject there, or rather respond before James, but of course I like everyone else, hope that the children are the future and that technology is the future. But as Lynn mentioned, I think that we've seen some very disturbing trends. I work in the print media, in terms of how technology and the internet can be clamped down and controlled, A, but B, even if it was not, ultimately one of the very disturbing things that's happened with, as we saw in the film, is at the end of the day, even if people in China are accessing Apple Daily or the such like online, which young people are all consuming their media online, who is creating that content? And if the business model is attacked, which is what is happening by reportedly pressure on advertisers, then there is the people who don't want the bad stories to come out are attacking it on every level. So even if there wasn't an ability to control or censor the internet, where's that content going to come from? This is not the time or place to have a discussion about the challenges facing journalism, full stop. But I take, and we had a discussion earlier, the panelists with Ms. Chan, about how wonderful it is to see what scholarism and the other young activists are doing, and that's a great testament to what Hong Kong has achieved. And I have a lot of optimism about that as well. But in terms of technology and the other issues, I'm not so sure. James, sorry, I interrupted. You were going to respond as well.
I mean, the scholarism managed to stop the national curriculum from coming in 2012. That's a pretty big achievement, I think. But I think it also depends what line the central government takes. And it seems like in the last year, they've decided to really take a very hard line. Young people in Hong Kong, I'm not sure what they can do to stand up for that. I hope they can. I hope we can. But,
So, based on the research you've done for this one that you just shown and the the one that's coming up about Occupy Central, if you were to try to look in a glass ball, leading the 2 or 3 years leading up to 2017. How do you think this is going to play out? First of all, when it comes to press freedom, you think this is going to be this continued drip erosion of press freedoms? What's the best guess, the best scenario among people that you've interviewed? Or the most likely scenarios?
I think that Apple Media will continue to be under attack. They'll try to muzzle the few voices that are still speaking up. There may be like blogs online which still are able to speak up, but in terms of the news industry, I think it's going to be more and more of like a steady erosion. Really, that's what I think.
Oh, thanks for that. I really wasn't so much aware of the personal danger that so many of those journalists faced. So I thought that was really brought home in your documentary. Well done on that. And my question is sort of following on from that is, what's your take on the law and order side of the story? Do you think that the police and the courts have any kind of power to help prevent this or bring justice to these people?
It's really hard to tell. There's a lot of speculation going on. A lot of us, I think, believe that he was attacked for his work as a journalist, But I think it's pretty clear, judging from what police and the and have said in the media so far, that they're trying to not make that connection. And without speculating too much, it's hard to think that there would be any other reason to go after him.
He was part of a consortium of journalists. I think there was some in Australia and in Taiwan as well, maybe.
All over the world.
They worked
with the guy in the international affair. He investigated the leaked documents.
They were looking into the offshore accounts of the Chinese leaders. You know how money was being kind of put away in these. That's like just speculation as to whether that was the reason he was attacked or not.
If I may, just to respond, and other people in the audience may have some thoughts about your question as well, and please, if they do, this is an open discussion as well. I'm sure James and they would love to hear other people's thoughts. But just in specific response to your question, I mean, we've had the chief executive and the chief secretary here and to talk to us about the importance that they place in freedom of the press and why they think it's important and a core value of Hong Kong's. And of course, after the attack on Kevin Lau, they came out very strongly, and I think rightly. And we're all glad to see how strongly they came out. And if justice, one of the challenges with the attack is, I think, like Mark Simon said in your movie, it was more likely to be a situation, in my opinion, as he said, of people bringing gifts to Caesar, or in another kind of analogy, the Archbishop of Canterbury who's going to rid me of this pesky priest kind of situation, rather than a specific order from the liaison office that we don't like Kevin Lau and we're going to hack him. So bringing to justice, I mean, they've already arrested people. There will be people jailed, but will we ever know whose great idea it was to do that horrible thing? I don't know. And again, if anyone has any thoughts or contributions, please.
The other journalists you interviewed, did you get a sense of fear or, you have to really be worried about your, not only your livelihood, but your life.
You'd expect when you're making a documentary about press freedom that a lot of journalists want to talk and share their ideas and views with you. We actually had trouble getting people to talk to us, some people, because of fear. People were afraid to be too upfront. There were people who declined our requests because they didn't want to affect their livelihoods. So I think you know when you're trying to control the press, and I come from Singapore where the press is very different from what it is here, you don't really need to do a lot. You just need to make sure that enough people are fearful and start checking themselves, and then you would be able to create a situation where the press is not so free. So making this, we've seen what fear has done to some journalists in Hong Kong. It's understandable, but it's also very sad. And it's something to think about. And I think it's good that clubs like the FCC are standing up. But we kind of feel that with more fear, with more rules in China, people will start thinking that, okay, maybe I shouldn't overstep certain boundaries and not speak up so much.
Well, I've already said something, but I guess two points. One, I've been really astonished at the way business and the professions have gotten off basically scot-free in their condemnations, in their sort of, I'm sorry, gangbang of Occupy Central. It's been reported in the international press, but no one has put the different threads together and made a single sharp editorial saying, what the hell is international business doing in Hong Kong going along with this attack, the attack on Occupy Central, which basically amounts to calling, to claiming that Occupy Central is about violence. That's the August 17th actions are all playing up the notion that Occupy Central is about violence, when those poor people have been saying from day one they're about civil disobedience. And a sit-in, even of 10,000 people somewhere in Central, is very different from violence. So this is really a question for the international media. Why haven't they come out more strongly against this? The rule of law, as you caught the people, the hedge fund manager and his associates who are supporting Occupy Central, they made the very valid point that the free flow of information is vital to markets, and censorship runs against that. And that's a point that you can make more broadly about Occupy Central and the business opposition to it. So I'm sort of looking at you, Doug. But yeah, that's really my question. Why have they gotten such a free? Why has business gotten such a free ride on this? I think they're disgraceful. I mean, they, big business, the accountancy firms, the rest of them, I didn't realize that HSBC, Stan Chart, and Bank of East Asia were all pulling ads from Apple Daily. But it's really shocking.
I'm happy to respond to that, but before I do, are there any other kind of contributions there, so that we can take a bunch of them or thoughts?
I have a question, right?
Please.
Did you try to talk to anyone in the business community? Do you want to take that first? And
yeah, Edward Chin, he's in the business community. He's a hedge fund manager. And his group of about 70 people are also in the finance industry. So I think we wanted to talk to someone in business to find out what they thought about freedom of the press. And you know, that was really the point about the free flow of information and how that's important for people to make business decisions. You know, if you don't have the right kind of information, then your business is going to suffer. And I agree. I think people are like, you know, cutting off their noses in spite of their faces. It's a real shame to see this happening. And there's a strange kind of a travesty, if you will, where people are kind of getting dressed up in the clothing of democracy, of free speech, but the intention is in the end to stifle those things. And I think you can see it as well with the hacking into Mark Simon's email accounts recently as well. So many people, you go online, you look at comments, and so many people, gleefully attacking him and attacking many in the democracy, the pan-democrats. Do we really want to live in a place where someone can go into your computer, steal your private correspondence, and then, when you've done nothing illegal, give that to the press, and for your reputation to be smeared, to be mudslung at you? You know, I mean, to me, and yet that is being kind of defended as you know, freedom of the press. To me, it's just crazy. It's the whole thing is kind of the wrong way around. And I think also, you know, if we want to live in that kind of society, then you are cutting off the nose in spite of your faces. Because, you know, the minute that someone doesn't like what you stand for, like they don't like what Jimmy Lai stands for, they can do the same thing to you. So, you know, to me, it's it doesn't make any sense. But, yeah. I think they reported it to the police just last Wednesday, and they're now starting to investigate. That's as far as I know. So I think it's under police investigation now.
Having worked for a few financial institutions, they're just treating Occupy Central like basically a terrorist attack. You know, it goes to their contingency planning. It's a bit like when we did the year 2000 thing. I was told by the company I was working for at that time that if all of the banks go down, that is not a problem. But if our bank goes down and everybody else is trading, that's a big problem. And this is the way they're treating Occupy Central at the moment, that it's an inconvenience, and we've got to have contingency plans in place to overcome that problem, rather than thinking, why Occupy Central? You know, shouldn't we be supporting it in principle? And none of them seem to have done that.
Just to respond to, I think, the question that was put to me earlier, and purely in my position as a former president of the FCC, I guess I have. I have read in the international media editorials criticizing, for example, the Hong Kong affiliates of the Big Four accounting firms for their position on Occupy Central. I think you know that there have been reports in the international media which have talked about some of the things that you've mentioned. But you know, as a journalist who talks to financial institutions, international financial institutions, I mean, clearly what our audience member said just now is entirely true. I mean, I think that it's just as it is for local media, for international media, for any business. You know, one of the big things that we're all dealing with is China is going to be China is Rome to America's Greece. How every company in the world is trying to work out how to cope with that. And you know, Hong Kong is the canary in the coal mine, I think, that is really kind of chirping away and doing the hard, heavy lifting for the rest of the world and fighting the good fight. And I think that's why I'm so proud to be an adopted Hong Konger. We all hope the canary doesn't die. It's coming close to 9. I don't know, Lynn, James. You know, are you happy to continue as long as people are? I mean, I don't want to keep anyone, but we're very happy to keep this going here. Or some of us could adjourn downstairs. Please, if anyone would like to ask something, raise something. Yep, please, and then the lady in the front.
Hello, I just wanted to say something. I feel slightly uncomfortable about this discussion, which on the whole has been very informative and very engaging, that it's beginning to sound a little bit provincial. And when you say that the Hong Kong is the canary in the cage, I'd like to know what other people's impressions are about whether anybody else in the world is interested in what happens to that canary. You know, there's not a lot of democracy going on in Moscow in South America. There's lots of other places where there's huge challenges for freedom of speech and press freedom. There are journalists going to jail in London because the state doesn't like the way they've transacted their business. So without extending the whole of the discussion to journalism in the world today, I just felt slightly uncomfortable about getting a bit too, let's look at one canary, because I'm not sure the rest of the world's bothered about Hong Kong's canary one way or the other, I'm afraid.
It's always a mistake when I talk, but Ms. Chan, just take the contribution from... Oh, let's take Ms. Chan's response straight to that.
Can I just respond to your question? It is true that I think for many years now, Hong Kong has completely disappeared from the radar of all our trading partners. But as some of you will probably know, you can hardly not know with all the splash of criticisms, is that Martin Lee and I went to America in April, and we went to London just about 3 or 4 weeks ago. I think the clear impression we take with us after visiting America is that at least the American Congress and the State Department, they are concerned about Hong Kong. They're concerned about Hong Kong, not just, you know, Hong Kong being what it is, but I think they see it as their own, in their own self-interest, to maintain Hong Kong's core values, to protect their investments here. They have nationals here, they invest. And let's not forget, we have signed a whole raft of international agreements with countries like America, with the UK, with European countries, all of which are based on the assumption that we have a very distinct system in Hong Kong that is totally different from the rest of China. And if two systems no longer exist, then it puts at risk Hong Kong's ability to honor those obligations. And those obligations matter to other countries. Why? Because we cooperate in preventing human trafficking, narcotics, protection of intellectual property rights, etc., etc. And the impression we got after seeing people in the State Department and the Vice President is that America now realizes that at the end of the day, they are talking about protecting their own core values, which we happen to share. And so, in order to protect that, with an increasingly strong and aggressive China, I have the impression that the American government is at least prepared from time to time to put at risk that relationship with China in order to emphasize and to protect their core values. This is what we want to see in other countries that trade with Hong Kong. So I'm not as pessimistic as you are, but it does mean we have to keep on trying to make sure that we remain on the radar of our trading partners. It won't happen otherwise.
Just very quickly, I apologize because every time I speak, I kind of divert us. But I brought up the issue of that you criticized as that you pointed out could be taken as parochial. But a colleague of ours from Fairfax wrote a fantastic piece about why Hong Kong matters, and I'm gonna plagiarize that, or rather recognize that. But his argument was this: what's happening in Hong Kong now? And the potential lack of fulfillment of the commitments that China made under a legally binding international agreement, the Joint Declaration, is of critical importance to the rest of Asia and to the rest of the world. This is not to say that there's not horrible things happening in terms of freedom of the press around the world. There are a lot. But I'm a Malaysian. My country, all the other countries in Asia, are going to have to come to terms and work in every business in the world. And everyone in the world is going to have to come to terms with how we work with China. And if Hong Kong is standing up, the Hong Kongers are standing up for the commitments that China made regarding Hong Kong in an international agreement. And that's why I don't think it's as parochial as it could be criticized to be. So I'm going to stop now, and there's another question from the lady here in front.
I'll perhaps bring the temperature down a bit. Mine's not a question, just an observation, really. I'm a media teacher, and I have to teach news to 14, 15, 16-year-olds, and later teach broadcast journalism and documentary making to older students. And they, you know, as soon as you say, oh, so we're doing a unit on news, you know, you can see them all sort of opening up chat and everything else. It is hard to engage them, but what they do have a very strong sense of is justice. I often find they're quite engaged when I talk about, how journalists, you know, put their own lives in danger often. And I use international extreme examples, of people who have lost their lives. And really, your film is a gift because it's always quite hard to bring it to a local level for them. So I certainly plan to use your film in the classroom. So thank you very much.
Maybe we'll just take a few more rounding up comments, contributions, and then give Lynn and James the last word before I offer to buy anyone a drink downstairs who would like a drink.
Yeah, I'd just like to comment on a certain comment that was made by a member of the audience regarding people being locked up in London in jails, journalists. If they have broken the law, as they seem to have done, and it's been an open case, I think it's right that they're jailed. I don't see anything wrong with that, and I'm very sad to see it being included in this discussion. It's hardly like the same as the Al Jazeera guys in Egypt.
I'm not sure what our friend was referring to, but it's kind of relevant. Any other
final comments, contributions before a final word to Lynn and James?
Okay. I just want to say that as a long-time admirer of the freedoms that Hong Kongers enjoy. And as now someone living and working in Hong Kong, I really hope that not just journalists, but residents here will stand up and try and do something to protect these freedoms, because you don't know what it's like until you lose them, and they're worth protecting, they're worth standing up for. Yeah, they're really valuable.
Completely agree.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a round of applause for our filmmakers.